This is Radio Moscow. We present the story of Major Herman Titov's space flight. Five hours, 18 minutes in outer space, and more than 17 revolutions around the Earth. That was the record with which Herman Titov astounded the world. And while people waited with bated breath on every continent, Soviet astronaut number 2 radioed down from among the stars.
Major Titov addressed greetings to the Central Committee of the Communist Party, the Soviet government, and Premier Khrushchev. Everything was going fine, he said. He felt excellent, and all the apparatus on the spaceship was functioning normally.
When Herman Titov set foot on Earth after his memorable flight, he found a message waiting from Prime Minister Khrushchev. It read as follows.
The Soviet people as a whole, and all of forward-looking mankind, will remember your exploit for centuries to come as an example of courage and valor in the service of humanity.
Soviet astronaut number 2 had covered twice the distance from the Earth to the Moon on his spaceship Vostok 2, and the whole world congratulated the country that had produced such a hero.
Professor Lovell, director of Jodrell Bank, the British Observatory, described the achievement of Vostok 2 as a natural corollary of Gagarin's flight and another striking manifestation of the high level of development of Soviet science and engineering. Prime Minister Nehru of India declared in his message that such rapid progress in space travel offered man new prospects and taught the world that war on this small earth was madness. President Sukarno of Indonesia found it a remarkable victory that offered great possibilities for the exploration and conquest of space. And Yugoslavia's President Tito wrote, "We've all been greatly impressed by the unusual successes and achievements of Soviet science and engineering, which make such a rich contribution to human progress."
Herman Titov's flight, as it were, summed up all of the space research the Soviet Union had done ever since it first experimented with sending up animals on vertically launched rockets. One of the landmarks was the flight of Laika, the dog, on Sputnik 2 in November 1957. This experiment was enlarged upon in August of last year when the Soviet Union began to launch whole groups of animals on spaceships weighing more than 4 tons, and then return them to Earth. It was learned from these experiments that a living organism can spend as much as 24 hours in space without suffering ill effects. Once that was established, Yuri Gagarin circled the Earth on April 12th, and now Herman Titov has swung around it 17 times. Titov's spaceship Vostok 2 kept in touch with the Earth by means of 2 shortwave transmitters, with a 3rd one operating on ultra-short waves for use when the ship passed over the Soviet Union. There was also TV equipment on the ship, which enabled scientific staffs on Earth to observe the astronauts' condition. One camera provided a larger image, but with a narrower angle of vision, while the other supplied a broader angle. To date, only 2 Russians and 2 Americans have observed the Earth from outer space. Only these 4 men have seen the sky not above them, as the average person is accustomed to seeing it, but at their feet. Naturally, Major Titov was showered with questions on his return. Some pressmen caught him shortly after he landed. Others plied him with questions at a press conference in Moscow. Here are some of the most frequently asked questions with Herman Titov's reply. What did you see during the flight?
I saw a lot through the ship's portholes. I could make out rivers, mountains, and cultivated fields. Clouds were easily seen. The Earth's continents are distinctive in coloring as well as outline. Africa's main color, for instance, is yellow with spots of dark green jungles. The continent looks like a spotted leopard. I caught sight of the Tian Shan mountain range and the sparkling white peaks of the Himalayas. Another majestic sight was the long lines of waves in the Pacific and Atlantic racing after each other toward distant shores. Oceans and seas differ from each other in coloring, just as the continents do. The Indian Ocean is a deep violet blue, while the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico are a light green. At one point, through the black of night, I saw the lights of a big city. They looked like gold dust. The city was Rio de Janeiro.
Major Titov was asked how he felt during the flight and how the state of weightlessness agreed with him. This is what he said.
I felt each stage of the rocket separate and drop off. The state of weightlessness set in gradually after the last stage dropped away. My first sensation was strange. I felt as though I'd turned over and was flying upwards feet first. But that passed in a few seconds. I was without weight for a very long time, but I can now say that weightlessness does not interfere with work.
How did you eat out in space?
My dinner was specially prepared food in tubes. I had no plates, no spoons, forks, or napkins with me. The first tube would have weighed about 5 ounces on Earth. In space, it weighed nothing. The tube contained a cream soup, and I squeezed it into my mouth the way you do toothpaste. In the same way, I ate my meat and liver paste and my third course, which was blackcurrant juice, which I also squeezed from a tube. A few drops of the juice spilled and hung in midair before my face like berries. I collected them on the tube cap and swallowed them. It's just as easy to eat and drink in outer space as on Earth. I not only had dinner there, I also had supper and breakfast the next morning. My food was not only in tubes. I bit off small pieces of bread and chewed and swallowed them with vitaminized peas. And naturally, I drank water from a special receptacle. It was all very nice and Earth-like.
Major Titov was asked how he slept during the flight and whether he had dreams. This was his reply.
In general, I sleep well and never dream. I'd been assigned to rest and to sleep from the evening of the 6th of August until 2 in the morning of the 7th. So as not to float out of the chair, I tied myself fast and ordered myself to sleep. Doctors have taught us astronauts to drop to sleep at once whenever we wish and to wake up at a fixed time. So I closed my eyes and dropped to sleep. I awoke because of some strange condition of my body. My arms had risen of their own accord and were hanging in midair. It was a result of the state of weightlessness. I slipped my hands under the belts fastening me to the chair and looked at the lights on a special meter. They showed that the spaceship was on its 8th revolution round the Earth. I woke again on the 10th revolution and on the 11th. Looking at the meter each time, I dropped back to sleep at once. It's easy to sleep in outer space. There's nothing to turn over on. Neither your arms nor legs grow numb, and you feel as though you were floating in the sea. I was supposed to wake up for the last time and resume work at exactly 2 a.m. on the 7th, but I overslept 35 minutes. On Earth, they realized I was sleeping and gave me an opportunity to get a better rest. When I finally woke up, I radioed a report to Earth the first thing and then did setting up exercises.
Major Titov was asked to describe how he did exercises in such a state.
Any physical effort seems out of the question when your body has no weight. But our physicians and instructors had devised an original set of exercises. For one, I'd try to break loose from the chair to which I was tied. This was an exercise for the abdominal muscles. Other movements stretch the joints and put the muscles in working order.
How did the manual controls on the ship operate?
After an hour of flight, I'd been assigned to switch on the manual controls. To tell the truth, I felt nervous, for no one had ever driven a spaceship before. Would it obey me, I wondered, as I laid a hand on the controls. Vostok 2 did just as I wished. I guided it with the same ease with which I drive a car on Earth and operate a jet plane in the sky. It proved very simple. I could direct the spaceship wherever I wanted to at any time. With my hand on the controls, I felt like the captain of a wonderful ship. I was not particularly tense. In fact, I wasn't tense at all. Everything was as familiar as in a plane. Later, I again switched on the manual controls, this time more confidently, for I already knew how the ship would react.
What sort of contact did you have with the Earth during your flight?
The radio equipment functioned perfectly throughout the flight from takeoff until I landed. So from every point in the orbit, I could relay information to Earth, receive instructions, and speak by radio with headquarters and with the doctors and various experts. Reception was excellent. I could recognize people I knew by the tone of their voices and their intonations, and even picture to myself their expressions.
Major Titov was asked what radio programs he heard from the Earth. Here is what he said.
I heard the Soviet news agency announcement of my flight. I remember very well how the announcer read it. I picked up many stations all over the world. Some Japanese station was giving a lesson in Russian. Many times I caught Moscow and the music it was broadcasting. I'm very fond of Strauss waltzes and listen to them with pleasure.
How did you return to Earth?
The design of the spaceship and its landing system allowed for two possibilities. I could land in the capsule, or I could separate the pilot's chair from the ship and parachute down. It was left to me to decide. When the deceleration engine was switched on and the ship began to descend, I felt so well that I decided to try the second method. At a low altitude, I separated the pilot's chair from the ship and continued down by parachute. The ship landed safely a short distance away.
So much for the questions Hermann Titov was asked after returning from 25 hours in outer space. And now a few words about the Major himself. Hermann Titov was born on September the 11th, 1935, in central Siberia. His father taught the Russian language and literature in a local school. Being very fond of the great Russian poet Alexander Pushkin, he named his son Hermann after the hero of Pushkin's novel, The Queen of Spades. In the same way, he named a daughter Zemfira after the heroine of a Pushkin poem. Growing up in a Siberian village during the war, Hermann helped on the collective farm since so many men were away at the front. What he enjoyed most of all was gathering the hay. He liked to sleep in the fragrant haystacks and study the starry sky. As so often happens with boys, he very much wanted to become a tank driver, artilleryman, or the captain of a submarine. He finally made up his mind when a famous Soviet ace pilot, Alexander Pokrishkin, came out to that part of the country to spend his vacation at home. Hermann decided that he too would become a flyer. After high school, he went on to a flying school and graduated as a fighter pilot in 1957. That was the year the first Soviet Earth satellite was launched. Hermann became interested in space flights and resolved to train as an astronaut. Once enrolled as such, the young man soon attracted special attention both for his intelligence and learning and for his splendid health. His father had forbidden him to smoke, and Hermann had never even tried. Physicians say that his lungs are crystal clear. Early in life, young Titov became interested in sports. After he broke an arm, it was gymnastics that took all his time, because he learned that only gymnastics could restore his arm to normal. Later, he took up acrobatics and then cycling. These three sports remained his favorites until, as an astronaut, he had to train in all sports. Titov's friends speak of his stick-to-itiveness, and the scientists he has worked with while training for spaceflight praise him as a man of unusual ability. Several of his technical proposals for ground training have been found very suitable. Major Titov met the girl who was to become his wife while training as a fighter pilot. Black-eyed Tamara from the Ukraine and Herman had much in common, especially a passion for reading and studying and a boundless love of life. You will now hear the opinions of three leading Soviet scientists about some of the problems which Major Titov's flight solved. First, there is this question. Why should manned spaceflight be attempted in general? Couldn't automatic space laboratories supply science with all the desired information? Here is the opinion of Professor Krossovsky.
Manned space flights are not staged for the sake of sensation. Automatic equipment, however perfect, cannot replace the human brain. For example, in exploring the moon and planets, only man can select the most valuable specimens for dispatch to the Earth and perform experiments that could not be foreseen in advance. Besides, the radio telemetric equipment on a comparatively small spaceship would be unable to relay an endless amount of information to Earth because of the ship's limited power supply. A skilled astronaut, on the other hand, could select the most essential samples of soil, rock, and plant life, and record instrument readings and take pictures, thereby accumulating a practically inexhaustible store of information. Without a doubt, the question of whether there is life on other planets will never be completely solved until man has visited the planets.
Next, the opinion of Professor Vasily Parin about certain problems of cosmic medicine.
The flights of Yuri Gagarin and Herman Titov dispelled apprehensions that the state of weightlessness might do serious harm to a living organism. Both men felt well and were able to keep radio contact with the Earth, take instrument readings, write, and eat. However, there is another danger. Once an organism becomes accustomed to weightlessness, it'll find it more difficult to endure the opposite state of stresses and strains, which develops in the process of descent. And an organism will naturally grow accustomed to weightlessness if the astronaut travels for months and perhaps even years. Consequently, weightlessness must somehow be eliminated. In some man-made way, the pull of gravitation must be created, perhaps by rotating the capsule or the whole ship on its axis. One of the major obstacles to distant spaceflight is cosmic rays and the radiation belts that ring the Earth, says Professor Parin. Scientists believe there are several ways of protecting the space traveler from radiations. One might be the type of protection to be found at atomic power plants, only something of lighter weight. Another might be chemical protection. A search is on for chemical and pharmacological substances that make a living organism more resistant to radiation. There's also talk of using hypothermia. Until recently, hypothermia was the monopoly of science fiction. But now, scientists all over the world are studying its possibilities. Experiments have been tried on rats, white mice, and even dogs. The animals are put to sleep, and then their body temperature is reduced to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Though they appear dead at this temperature, they immediately revive when removed to a warm place. The heart begins to beat, respiration returns, and all the vital functions are renewed. Foreign scientists are of the opinion that a space traveler could more easily endure the difficulties of flight if he were in a state of hypothermia. Besides, he'd have no need for large supplies of water, food, or oxygen. However, it's still too early to say whether this idea is feasible.
And now a word about the problem of guiding a spaceship. The opinion comes from Professor Asratyan, corresponding member of the Soviet Academy of Sciences.
I see particular significance in the union of physiology and cybernetics. Up to now, automatic equipment has been used primarily to guarantee control of the spaceship, and physiologists have utilized the achievements of electronics to register the functions of a living organism on the ship. But further development of cosmonautics will apparently require some complicated systems whereby telemechanics will automatically come to the space traveler's assistance if for any reason his physical condition begins to deteriorate. By assistance, I mean not only taking over control of the spaceship,
but rendering first aid to the traveler. However, though automatic equipment may be able to do more and more, the decisive factor in space exploration will always be man, his intelligence, courage, and will to emerge the victor, whatever the obstacles.
The two manned space flights which the Soviet Union has undertaken offer science brilliant opportunities. We'd like to recall what Prime Minister Khrushchev said at the meeting in Moscow when Herman Titov was honored on his return from outer space.
We believe and we know that the time is not far off when spaceships guided by man will blaze a path to the moon and to the planets of our solar system.
Several thousand persons attended Major Titov's press conference at Moscow University on August 11th, at which President of the Academy of Sciences, Mstislav Keldysh, described the Soviet Union's plans for further space research in the following words.
Our scientists and designers are working on an extensive program which includes orbital flights and flights to the nearest planets. To fly to planets, the length of the flight must be increased, and rockets and spaceships will have to be improved. We'll be able to determine the program of the next flight after we've made a thorough study of all the scientific results of Herman Titov's wonderful experiment.
The discoveries of Soviet scientists belong to all of humanity. Our new findings, put at the disposal of all scientists and nations, should serve progress and peace. Herman Titov, at his press conference, also wished American astronauts success in the peaceful exploration of outer space. If the efforts of our two great nations are geared to that end, the whole world stands to gain from it. You've been listening to the story of Major Herman Titov's space flight on a feature prepared by Radio Moscow.